Welcome to CyberFix, your dopamine-infused tech news update. My name is Gabriel, and I'm here to help get other information junkies up to speed with important tech news. Stay tuned for a lighthearted exploration of hostile cyberspace and what we can do about it without taking ourselves too seriously. This is episode 4, which is being recorded on July 20th, 2024, and we'll be discussing a bit of wacky tech news, more Firefox woes, a solutions roundup, and then after the break, CrowdStrike, the biggest denial of service in history, the massive AT&T data breach, and then government in tech. Starting out with wacky tech news, we have TechDirt.com reporting $2,350 Amazon Astro business robots to become pointless paperweights 11 months after release. Quoting from the article, the robots will simply stop working on September 15th and unfortunately can't be repurposed in any way. Amazon is providing free recycling for your expensive and now completely pointless $2,300 robot. Business subscribers will at least get a refund for their units and $300 in Amazon credit. All personal data will be wiped from the device by Amazon. It's interesting to note they're not saying whether it's wiped from the servers. That's a whole other completely different ballgame. Again, quoting from the article, the home version of Astro is now only available as a 1600 invite-only preview. Hopefully these users don't have the same experience another few months from now. It is quite interesting to me how much fear porn there's been about, oh, the robots are ready, the AI is ready, it's time to push everyone out of the workforce. And it seems many of these quote-unquote solutions are dead on arrival. But this isn't the only Amazon product having trouble. The Bite on Futurism.com is reporting researchers call for child-safe AI after Alexa tells a little girl to stick penny in wall socket. This isn't even the first Alexa I've seen telling someone to do something dangerous, and actually, many AI products tend to tell people to do dangerous things as long as it is seen in some way beneficial to whatever the AI is trying to optimize for right now. For instance, a while back there was a guy who was told by some AI companion to commit suicide for the climate. Given the proliferation of effective altruists in AI circles, this is somewhat suspect to me. Truthfully, given the fact that we've allowed large tech corporations to run roughshod over all of society by censoring people's speech and surveilling them, I'm not really gonna bet the farm on child-safe AI being a thing anytime soon. It may be best to be careful about what droids you let enter your home. Next up, Web3 is going just great is reporting popular DeFi protocol websites replaced with wallet drainers amid mass Squarespace domain hijacking. Anyone who is hosting their DeFi infrastructure on Squarespace had their domains hijacked, which then ended up pointing people to tools that would basically steal all the cryptocurrency from the people who visit. This is an excellent reminder that not only do you have to be worried about suspicious links, but there are concerns with links you trust being so important that they can be hijacked and used against you. It's fascinating to note that not only Squarespace domains were hijacked. The post explains, somewhat ironically, Unstoppable Domains Web3 domain service was also impacted, and their site was offline for a while before they regained control. So I believe Unstoppable Domains itself would still be running, just not their website, which is a little ironic and kind of funny. Stack Diary is reporting Linksys VLOP routers send Wi-Fi passwords in plain text to US servers. The byline reads, it's as if the routers themselves forgot the first rule of cybersecurity. Don't write your secrets on a postcard. The article says that this discovery involves Linksys VLOP Pro 6E and VLOP Pro 7 mesh routers. Reading directly from the article, Linksys released a firmware update after the initial warning, but did not address the concerns raised. We regret the lack of response from Linksys and expected more from such a renowned brand, the researcher expressed. I'm not going to try to pronounce the researcher's name, but the article continues. He suspects the security issue might stem from third-party software used in the Linksys firmware. However, they emphasize that this does not excuse the vulnerability. For those who already own the affected routers, they have recommended changing the Wi-Fi network and password via the web interface instead of the app. This precaution prevents the SSID name and password from being transmitted in readable text. So what this means is that you've basically got your own Wi-Fi router handing out your password to basically who knows where, but it's sending it in clear text, which means anyone who's listening in on the line can also get that information. So this is a pretty serious problem to have. In general, I would recommend resetting your Wi-Fi network's name and password on a regular basis, at least the password, but name probably helps too, considering a lot of the other threats when it comes to Wi-Fi and security. I would also argue if you're living alone and you don't really need Wi-Fi for a lot of people, it may be better just to wire everything in as much as you can. For smartphones, that's a little different, but there are advantages to using mobile data depending on what you're trying to do. Moving on to Schneier on Security reporting, Cloudflare reports that almost 7% of all internet traffic is malicious. For those who aren't aware, Cloudflare is basically this giant man-in-the-middle service that provides DDoS protection for websites that are big enough that large DDoS attacks are a serious problem. There are ways to mitigate those attacks without Cloudflare, but I will admit they are a little expensive and a little complicated depending on what you're working with. I personally would estimate, if you count surveillance and advertising, a much larger percentage of internet traffic is malicious. It really depends on what your definition of malicious is. There's actually a really good comment here that they say, I don't trust them, meaning Cloudflare in this case, to judge this. And the example he gives is trying to load a specific text file over Tor. And then he explains, Cloudflare blocks the request, presumably assuming malice. There was also a several month period where I couldn't access the IETF site at all via Tor browser, along with many other websites, including Cloudflare's blog and Stack Exchange. Ironic and disappointing, given the content of that RFC and the IETF's occasionally proclaimed support for anonymity. Another interesting comment is, only 7%? Does that mean things are improving? I will certainly admit the problem of malicious internet traffic is not an easy one to solve. It's a good reason to run a device that is able to block connections coming into your network as well as those coming out, because unfortunately, as we saw earlier, we cannot even trust our own devices these days. If we ever could. Moving on to Firefox woes. This day's portion, Firefox's new website advertising preferences are a dark pattern, and the idea of private personalized ads is nonsense anyways. Reading from the post, what's going on at Mozilla? First, we get an arm-wavy post about how the organization is addressing an urgent need for privacy-preserving advertising solutions by buying an ad company. And then a few weeks later, Firefox introduces a new website advertising preferences setting, presumably powered by said ad company Anonym. Unbelievably, this setting, which will allow websites to perform privacy-preserving ad measurement, note the repeated use of privacy-preserving, is enabled by default, which means you have to opt out of ad measurement. He links to his other post about why this is a bad thing, and it is quite sad to see Firefox decline month after month, year after year. Fundamentally, a free open source web browser is an important thing, which is why I've covered Ladybird and other projects like Servo in recent CyberFix episodes. I really want to highlight the concept from this blog post when he calls this new introduction of a setting by default as a dark pattern. A dark pattern is basically the way a program or piece of software is laid out in a way that's pretty deceptive and manipulative. For instance, you're probably very familiar with these cookie banners, and some of them are pretty reasonable. There'll be a button and you can just not accept any of the weird cookies and tracking they are requesting, but then some, it's really hard to figure out how not to opt in when you're trying to read their article or view a post or do whatever on that particular website. Any deceptive layout that increases the barrier of somebody trying to do what they can normally be expected to do is effectively a dark pattern. What mostly makes it a dark pattern is when it is being done for a self-interested reason by, say, the company or the website, rather than for the user's preference. I certainly agree that this particular action qualifies as a dark pattern, because the research definitely shows that most people will not deviate from default settings. And now, starting the solutions roundup, still sticking to the Firefox theme, I'm going to share in the links here a link to the Firefox Hardening Guide 2024 by brainfucksec.github.io. In my opinion, browser hardening and hardening of any system, which is the idea of really trying to change systems or change configurations however you can to make it more private or at least as secure as it can be, it's really important to keep in mind that there are always going to be trade-offs. If you want something that will work on every website without any issues, you're going to have to give up some privacy. If you want maximum privacy, you have to realize you may have to give up particular websites. It's a trade-off. You can choose whatever balance you like. Truthfully, I am very concerned about how invasive this has gotten. And again, I'll reiterate my call that it is crucial to think about how we can build and support a better browser that doesn't enable all this and require this kind of weird workarounds just to have a browser that can be reasonably expected to browse the web. One of the solutions that is discussed a lot when it comes to at least trying to lower the dopamine feedback loop in your brain to phone addiction, or either simply just trying to have a more private experience in general, many people will switch to dumb phones. Dumb phones are generally called feature phones in the business lingo. TechRadar.com has an interesting review here. I used a dumb phone for a week. Here are five things I loved and five things I missed. Starting out with what he loved barely having to charge. Many feature phones don't require as much constant charging. Many smartphone users will have to make sure their phone is charged every single day. On a feature phone, sometimes it can last a couple of days to even a week, depending on how consistently you're using it. In his particular case, he would require people to just send him a simple text message so that everything would go through that phone. Quoting from the article, I basically use WhatsApp for every form of communication, but given that every app these days has some kind of built-in communication tool, I'm often overwhelmed by random unwanted messages on Facebook Messenger, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, any form of email, Strava, the list goes on. None of that on the Nokia, though. No, to reach me on the Nokia 3210, you need to know to text me. And it meant I could keep the invite list to my phone very small indeed. No more random spam messages throughout the day. I could be the hermit I wanted to be. I'll share some of the interesting things he missed in the review. He missed Googling answers to stupid question, you know, with a smartphone right in hand and ready to go anytime. It is pretty convenient to just simply Google any query that comes to mind. Next up, they miss being able to type at a reasonable speed. And that personally is my biggest barrier to adopting a feature phone myself. I do really like being able to type fast. In fact, I'm glued to my desktop most of the time because I would rather use that than even my smartphone or a laptop. And the last and kind of funniest example is always knowing where my phone is. Yes, because if you were less dependent on a device, it becomes so much easier to misplace. If they're only getting contacts from people when it's important, then suddenly that thing might be not interacted with for a day or two. And if you haven't seen an object for a day or two, it's pretty easy to misplace. Quoting from the post, it's got an interesting little thing here. This slender little compact device kept disappearing about my person. I couldn't easily send which of my pockets it was in just by the sensation of it digging around my leg. I'd have to hunt around by patting myself down like I was preparing for a flight. Another item in this solutions roundup is by thepodcasthost.com. What is podcasting 2.0 and why should I care? Podcasting 2.0 is an extension of the RSS namespace so that those who are building feeds for RSS feeds, which are pretty decentralized and very handy, being used by podcasting apps, there is a desire to extend the format to support many features. These features can include things like chapters, transcripts, even other fancy things like monetization features. But some of those are pretty easy to adopt even if you're writing your own XML for your RSS feed, but others are clearly intended with a dynamic host in mind. Personally, what I like about podcasting in general is the simple elegance of providing a feed and anybody can use any app they want, and that the feed itself can be written in pure text. So I worry that the dependence on the fancier features is going to consolidate the space because we have a problem right now where the user experience for self-hosting is quite a challenge for people. So I anticipate that while podcasting 2.0 will add many amazing features to the podcasting space, I worry that those features will accelerate ways in which podcasts may be more reliant on centralized consolidated platforms rather than distributed and decentralized ones. Again, the beautiful thing about podcasts is you can serve it from just a simple text file you put up yourself, media files you have in the same folder, and put it on any web host or even distributed in offline fashion. In my opinion, the greatest advantage of podcasting 2.0 is that there is a standard in place to add extended functionality to podcasts, and that itself is worth celebrating because many open source clients and even some closed source ones are adopting this standard. I think raising awareness of this is a great way to get those features become more commonplace. If I had a team around me doing what I am doing solo, I would definitely be taking the effort to put more things such as chapters and transcriptions into these episodes, but I simply unfortunately do not have the time. One of the sites that I highly recommend browsing when you have the time is Firewalls Don't Stop Dragons. The creator of the site does an amazing job explaining many technical solutions out there in a easily to digest way. His book, Firewalls Don't Stop Dragons, is an excellent starting point to learn more about what you can do. This particular post is how and why to block ads, and I think the why is almost more important than the how. The biggest problem with ads these days, in my opinion, is how personalized ads include a very high level of invasive tracking. This invasive tracking has so many unintuitive consequences that I think we're only really beginning to scratch the surface of these problems. I did a video on this called Data Shedding, a Real-Time Privacy Risk. Another great thing about this post is that it absolutely explains the fact that there are many different ways to block ads, and they all have their different trade-offs, so it's really worth evaluating the different methods to look into what you want to get out of blocking ads and potentially other trackers as well. Last up on the solutions roundup, Klaus Zimmermann's Corner has a post here titled Reaching the End of the Line Regarding Proprietary Operating Systems. The post starts with, "These days, I cannot help but feel the world is being encroached by a wave of privacy-invading and downright evil software platforms and operating systems. Telemetry, bogus or deceiving privacy policies, Copilot Plus, questionable vulnerabilities that may mask backdoors, you name it. As fast as the mainstream tech press is normalizing this as an essential part of how the industry works and your devices operate, we in free Libra open source software learn our countermeasures and ways to adapt around them in an internal arms race of sorts. There's a critical point that isn't covered through our expertise, the people around us that we care about." Continuing the post, "Let's be real. Knowing what the term FLOSS means already classifies us as not average people, maybe not even normal, whatever that might mean in the context. We are computer people. We get it. We know our ways around technology, but even all this knowledge is faint when the support is meant for somebody else less tech savvy. Parents, grandparents, extended family, they won't sometimes can't keep up with this." Continuing along, "Which brings me to the topic of this essay. I feel that I'm reaching the end of the line regarding what OS my dearest people around me use as this year comes to a close. At this moment, their computers are stuck with two aging operating systems, Windows 10, End of Life Previewed 2025, Mac OS Catalina, End of Life in 2022. I'll let you read the rest of the post. It's absolutely worth giving some serious thought, but he continues on by explaining that the idea of switching to a Linux distribution itself is not a simple thing. He then elaborates on some pros and cons of various different distributions of Linux that are available, but outlines some of the challenges involved with going in those particular routes. And his conclusion really echoes with my mission for the Libra Solutions Network as a whole. It is very challenging to improve the technological landscape for other people without educating them at least on the basics. And this is challenging because everybody is pressed for time in so many different ways, and it applies to many problems beyond just technological issues. My personal approach to this problem is not to be in too much of a rush to get yourself or other people in the perfect state. I think the ideal approach is focusing primarily on the information so that people are making educated choices, but then after that point, trying to take gradual steps from where people are to where they would like to be in a way that empowers people rather than simply just taking all their devices and throwing Linux on them and telling them they have to deal with it. Fundamentally, if you have the time and patience, absolutely support someone transitioning away from Windows or Mac to a reasonably good setup Linux system. But that itself is no small task. It is one thing to set up a system for yourself when you're able to troubleshoot it at your will. It's a whole other different task to set up a system for somebody else with much less hands-on interaction on your part. Again, my advice in this scenario would be very conservative and not try to promise the moon. Somebody switching to a Linux system is going to have a bit of a learning curve no matter how well the transition goes, simply due to the fact that many of the software available is different. But I hope you can have fun. Maybe it's something that's worth connecting with somebody over. Maybe instead of doom scrolling on TikTok all day, people can spend the time to flash Linux on each other's computers and learn about how free software works and how they can adopt more offline first workflows instead of enabling these corporations and all their terrifying machinations. Next up, we have the Hacker News reporting SAP AI core vulnerabilities expose customer data to cyber attacks. This is another fascinating example of AI really just making everything worse. Quoting from the start of the article, cybersecurity researchers have uncovered security shortcomings in SAP AI Core, cloud-based platform for creating and deploying predictive artificial intelligence workflows that could be exploited to get a hold of access tokens and customer data. Further along, the article writes, "The vulnerabilities we found could have allowed attackers to access customers' data and contaminate internal artifacts, spreading to related services and other customers' environments," security researcher Eli Ben Sasson said in a report shared with the Hacker News. Well, that's downright troubling, and I believe this is a fascinating example where many people will compare AI to databases and search engines, because this is like you have a company that runs every system on the same database without any strong distinctions between whose data is what, because fundamentally the AI does not have those distinctions. It's definitely interesting to see how the hasty implementation of AI into security or enterprise software can absolutely backfire in tremendous ways. It's crucial now more than ever, now that we know there are many shortcomings with software as it exists, that we should be more careful, not more hasty, to introduce novel things and focus on the basics of security, efficiency, and good stewardship. And now, we'll be back with CrowdStrike, the biggest denial of service in history, after these messages. According to our baseless speculation, 1 in 10 people will experience catastrophic data loss this year. Many people right now are completely unaware that they have data without backups that is going to be lost to entropy forever. Data loss can cause devastating experiences, including, but not limited to, losing access to photos and videos of precious memories, being locked out of accounts that needed two-factor authentication, which can leave you having to reorganize your entire digital life, sleepless nights searching for backups that were not done beforehand. Ask yourself if regular backups are right for you. But hey, look on the bright side. If you do lose it all, think of everything that's no longer bothering you. Now you'll never have to have your day decided by emails or social media notifications ever again. You've escaped the technological terror and crawled out of the parasocial hell that is the modern digital landscape. You're now free to choose your own destiny. How will you live in your new carefree life? Are you too busy for digital nihilism? Eventually, we all come crawling back to digital systems. Hopefully, you don't have to start all over again. The most important thing is to follow the famous 3-2-1 rule. 3 copies in 2 places, one of them being entirely offline. Visit gabe.rocks/backups to learn more. Thank you for listening to this free preview of CyberFix. Please share and consider becoming a supporter to gain access to the entire broadcast. There are 2 ways to gain access to the entire show. 1, the easiest method is to go to gabe.rocks/substack and purchase a paid subscription. 2, for the cyber rebels among you, go to gabe.rocks/monero and sign up for a subscription over the Fediverse. Links will be available in the description.